You guys, as we continue our worship, we really want this to be not a teaching environment. We want this to be a place where you come and you worship the Lord and connect with Him. Now, we want to teach the Bible, but I've said it before, and I want to say it again. My job is not to teach the Bible. My job is to teach you the Bible. It's a difference. I want to reach you. So if I have to stand on my head up here today to help you hear it, I'll give it a try. And so I might get a little excited today because there are some really cool things today in what we're going to look at. So we're in a series called It's No Joke. It's not a joke of what Jesus was teaching, and it's not a joke of where he was headed towards Good Friday, where he would be executed, but also Easter morning, where he would be resurrected. It is no joke. It's not a story. It's a truth. And it is not a joke because that's April Fool's Day, and we're going to say, no, this really happened, okay? So it's called It's No Joke. What we're doing is we're covering seven parables in the Gospel of Matthew that Jesus told during what we call the Passion Week or the last week of his life. And so we're covering those parables, and a parable is this. It is a simple story that is used to illustrate a moral or spiritual lesson. A simple story. It's an earthly story that has an heavenly meaning. Is really what it's all about. And in fact, it's a story that has one primary point as its focus. That's kind of a unique thing about a parable. Not everything is meant to be totally, it all needs to make sense, but there's kind of one point that he's driving at, and we'll try to get to that today. And today's is not an easy one. But it's these points are used by Jesus to exact the cost of being intimate with him and with his kingdom. That's what he said during the last week of his life. He took that opportunity not to just slap backs and hug babies. You know, he really brought some things to bear. It was really an important week as he was with his disciples and he is with the religious leaders of his day. He was going to drive this thing really home, and he was going to say some really tough things. Not that he hadn't said them before, but he was going to say them again during this last week of his life. And so we've been looking at that. In fact, here are the ones we've covered so far. We've covered the parable of the fig tree. In the point of the whole thing of the fig tree, and you can see it growing, it's just amazing what's going on up here, is that genuine faith is revealed by substance, not just appearance. It's not just the fact that it has leaves, but it's revealed by the fact that it has fruit. That's why he cursed the fig tree, because it had leaves but no fruit. It would have had the appearance of religiousness, but no substance to it. And that's why he cursed it. Then we talked about the parable of the two sons, the two sons that were asked to go into the vineyard and work. And one said, no thanks, Dad. You know, not interested in obeying you. And then eventually he went, though, because he had a change of heart, a change of mind. The other son said, yeah, got it, Dad, I'll be there, and never shows up. And this is all about obedient faith that's revealed in our actions, not just our words, not just giving lip service, but realness to it. Then we talked about this last week, the parable of the tenants, so these people who took over to rent a vineyard. And they rejected everybody who came to the vineyard to take the owner's part. They rejected everyone, even the son. And the point was this, is that the son is really actually the cornerstone of life. That's what Luke was talking about this morning. And that essential faith is focused on Christ as the cornerstone. Because from the cornerstone, this big, huge rock at the corner, every corner of the building, it's where the building gets its strength and its orientation from. Okay, and so when you reject him, you're left without any strength and any clarity as to what life's all about. And that's what he's talking about. Now, today we're going to talk about the parable of the wedding banquet, okay? Now, I couldn't find a picture of a first century wedding. I Googled forever and I couldn't find one. So I took one of a more recent wedding. So the parable of the wedding banquet. And these people are celebrating. Have you ever been to a wedding and it was just such a great celebration? That it was just so much fun. For Di and I, this past summer, our daughter got married. And you guys, we just look back and we just had so much fun on that day. I almost felt guilty having so much fun. It felt like, wow, should you have this much fun? I mean, we just had so much fun. We look back and in the pictures, either everybody's smiling or Tori and Brad are kissing. Every picture is that. And it was so much fun. But we're going to talk about this parable of the wedding banquet today. But I want to start at the end. Here's the point Jesus is going to make, and it's kind of a hard one. And then we'll work our way to it. So we'll work our way into that point. Okay, so at the end of this parable, he says this in verse 14. For many are called, but few are chosen. Circle it, chosen. He's going to make few. Many are called, many are invited, but few are chosen. So you get into this kind of whole controversy between what we call kind of Reformed or Calvinistic theology or Arminian theology on the other side. Calvinists say, would be on the extreme would say some are chosen to go to heaven, some are chosen to go to hell. That's just the way it is. God is sovereign enough to do that. So if you're chosen to go to hell, too bad, that's just the way it is. Now, it's not quite that crass, but it's kind of that way. But way over here, the Arminian would probably say, you know what, it's really up to you. God has really no ability to really affect it. It's going to be your choice. You have free will. God's just going to kind of wring his hands and hope that you make a decision because he's kind of weak. And those two extremes probably don't work. There's something in between, and I think it says, the Greek word for chosen here is ekletaloi. And ekletaloi basically means this. It is the mysterious interaction and sequence of the sovereignty and drawing call of God that results in conviction and surrender of the will of man. Clearly, the scriptures teach that none of us can come to him without him drawing us. That we don't have the ability in ourselves to make it to God, to even have a heart to desire to do that. We are so broken and so alienated that we can't do that, that we need God to work in our lives. But that as he works and calls, that he allows us our free will. Because real love has to have free will, right? It has to have free will. You know, if there was a pill that you could give someone else to take to have them love you, let's call it a purple pill, and you could give it to them, and they would love you every moment of every day. There's something about that seems attractive, isn't it? You know, like, oh man, they're just going to, you know, just love me all the time. But eventually you'd begin to question, do they love me because of the pill? Or do they love me because of them and because of me? Is it an honest free will love? Because you really want someone who's going to love you out of their own decision to move towards you and love you. Right? It's not a pill. But that God, he, in his sovereignty and his drawing of us towards himself, it results in this conviction of our heart that who he is true and right. And there is a surrender of our will to him. That's what this means. So many are called, but only few respond. Only a few to his calling draw in our lives. Not everyone does. And I think we're going to find that in this story. So let's go to the beginning of the story and work our way to this and see what it has to say, okay? So let's go to verse 1 here in Matthew 22. And it says, and again, Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, so here's the deal. Jesus is again in the temple. It's right after the parable he had just told about the cornerstone, about the tenets. And he's still in the temple area, and he's teaching not only his disciples, but the scribes and the Pharisees and those who had gathered around him. And he says, you know what? Let me tell you another story. And he's going to drive something home here. So he says, and again, Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, now look at this. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. Now, circle it. Actually, in the Greek, feast is plural. Wedding feasts. But in our culture, that would be very confusing. Like, well, what does that mean? So they translate it as a singular, but it's actually plural of the wedding feast of the son. Now, let me just tell you. In first century times, a Jewish wedding would have basically three parts. Okay, the first part would start with what we call the betrothal or the engagement, very much like we do here in the United States. There's an engagement where there's an agreement. We're going to get married. It was usually done by the families who made the agreement. Now, if you're an older adult with kids, you go, this is a great idea that we would arrange this, you know? But if you're younger, you think, are you crazy? I'm never going to let mom and dad choose for me. But hopefully it's kind of an interactive thing. And frankly, even in New Testament times, it wasn't forced on a person. It was normally kind of done in a negotiated way. But they would eventually arrange for this betrothal. And it was very legally binding. To break off an engagement or a betrothal was a legal experience. You had to go get a divorce, even to get unengaged then. And so what would happen, though, they'd get engaged, and then there was a protracted time, 6 months, 8 months, maybe 10, maybe even 12 months, where they would kind of prepare for the wedding. That's kind of what we do today. But one of the things they would do there is they would agree on the payment of the wedding. That means that if I'm the dad of the groom, that means the other dad's going to lose his daughter because she came to live with the groom's family. And so I would pay a dowry. I would pay him for her. And it wasn't meant to be like slavery. It was just meant to say, I respect you. You're going to lose her kind of activity in the family. And so there was a dowry. Or maybe the groom would pay it, but they would pay that. And they'd arrange all that. So that's the first part, the betrothal. The second part then was coming and getting her. And so there would be an arranged day that she was prepared to become, he's going to come over and he's going to bring all of his family and friends over to her house. It's probably right in the late afternoon or early evening, and they'd have torches, and it was an incredibly celebratory time, and they'd come and get her. And then the whole kit and caboodle would come back to the guy's house, and the whole town knows what's going on. It's this celebration. Everybody's cheering, like, wow, they're getting married. It's cool, and there's all sorts of things going on. Everybody's dressed cool, and they come back. And eventually, usually that first evening, it was just a dance. They just dance. They just have a party. The next day, she would go and kind of sequester herself away with her bridesmaids. And the day was all preparation. And then in the evening, they would come together for this wedding, for this time of exchanging their commitment to each other. And it was like a fabulous thing. And it was a feast. So they had a dance the first night. They had the wedding the second night. And then usually this banquet lasted for several more days. That's why it says feasts. There were a bunch of parties all along the way, and they would celebrate it. And that's not just this couple, but it's these two families coming together. And it's not just two families, it's an entire community that was involved because they were very much connected to this community. So the entire place, the whole village was in a party because they were celebrating this beautiful thing of what God was doing. And so here it says, this is a king, he's giving a wedding feast for his son. Wow, this is cool. Now look at this, go to verse 3. Well, in fact, let's do this. You guys, there's going to be a wedding feast someday in Revelation 19. It's going to be the most incredible thing that's ever happened. It's going to be the most amazing party you've ever seen. Look at this in Revelation chapter 19, verses 6 through 10. It's going to be the wedding banquet of the Lamb. It's going to be, we don't know exactly when it's going to be, but sometime after the church is raptured, those believers on earth are raptured, and they're going to be joined to the Son in this wedding feast. Look at this. It's described somewhat. It says verse 6. Then I heard what seemed to be the voice of a great multitude. This is John's vision that God has given him. The angels have spoke to him in Revelation 19. And so as he heard what seemed to be a voice of the great multitude, like a roar of many waters and like the sound of mighty peals of thunder crying out. I mean, you almost have to like really put drama into this, right? Because you can't have peals of thunder and sounds like many waters roaring without giving it some oomph, right? So here's what's going on. And the first word, exclamation point, hallelujah. To God be the praise, is what he's saying. For the Lord our God, the Almighty reigns. Let us rejoice and exalt and give him the glory. For the marriage of the Lamb, Christ being the Lamb of God, the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. The bride being the church of Christ, his people, they've prepared themselves and made themselves ready. It was granted her to clothe herself with fine linen, bright and pure. She gets to wear this beautiful, glorious, pure linen dress because God has made her that way. Is that stunning? We'll talk a little bit more, but we come with our brokenness, and he makes us pure. Wow. For the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints that God has given us. Wow. Look at this in verse 9. And the angel said to me, write this. Blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. Wow. And he said to me, these are the true words of God. And then John, look what John does. In the midst of John being so close to God, he turns to being an idol worshiper. Look at this. He goes, then I fell down at the feet to worship him, the angel. He bends down to worship the angel. Like, what kind of crazy man are you? And look at this. The angel's so smart. He says, then I fell down at the feet to worship him, but he said to me, you must not do that. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers who hold to the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, circle it. He says, don't worship me. I'm just a fellow servant, just like the rest of you, who come to focus on him. Worship God, not me. Are you nuts? For the testimony of Jesus is the testimony of prophecy. The testimony of Christ is the testimony of proclaiming the truth. That's what prophecy is, proclaiming the truth. That's the testimony of Christ, is to testify of the truth. He goes, man, this wedding of the Lamb to his bride is to worship him. Wow, that's incredible. Now, let's go back to the parable of the wedding banquet. With that as a backdrop, it's going to happen sometime down the road. He says, and he sent his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding feast. But they wouldn't come. Wow, they wouldn't come. Look at verse 4. And again he sent other servants, saying, tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast. You know, there's shadows here, clearly, of God having sent prophets to invite people to the wedding feast. And they didn't come. People didn't come. In fact, look at this. It says, but they paid no attention. And they went off, one to his farm and another to his business. They were too busy doing their farming and their businesses to pay attention to God, to be invited to the wedding feast. They were too busy. Had other things to do. God, you're not a high enough priority to us. I don't really care. I'll do what I need to do. I'm consumed with the here and now. Look at this in verse 6. There were others, it says, and while the rest seized the servants and treated them shamefully and killed them. Not only are there some that are just too busy for God, others are hostile towards him. Because they're invited to the wedding feast, but they say, hey, no thanks, I'm busy. Or, I don't know who you think you are, God, but I'm going to kill these people who came and talked because I'm hostile towards you. That's a reality in our world today. Some would suggest that probably America is more the ones who seem too busy for God. Just too busy. We got other things going. God, I don't really have time. Not now, not yet. I'm busy doing other things. I was on an airplane coming back from Haiti, in fact, going to Chicago, and a gal sitting next to me was, she in fact had been at 17 years old, had escaped, had defected from Cuba. She was one of their volleyball players. And she defected, and she was no longer playing volleyball, but I said, have you ever considered where God fits in your life? And she goes, yeah, I've considered it, but I'm just too busy right now. I'm not interested. I have things to do. I mean, it was just exactly this statement. And I thought, I understand, I get it, but when you really boil it down, is there anything so important in life that we say, God, I don't have time for you? It seems a little crazy, doesn't it? But it's the way we behave. Look at this, and they killed them. Look in Luke 13, verse 34. It says, O Jerusalem, this is Jesus speaking. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. He desires to bring us in, but we're just not willing. Wow. Well, let's go to verse 7. It says, as a result, the king was angry, and he sent his troops and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. And then he said to the servants, now look at this. This is fabulous. The wedding feast is ready, but those invited were not worthy. Go, therefore, to the main roads and invite to the wedding feast as many as you find. If they won't come, if they're people who are too busy or are too hostile, then let's invite the others. Go everywhere. Go everywhere and invite them, as many as you find. In verse 10, and those servants went out into the roads and gathered all whom they found, both bad and good. So the wedding was to be filled with guests. Go find everybody. doesn't matter what's going on in their lives. It doesn't matter where they're at. Go invite them. Everyone, the homeless, the lame. In fact, look at this, you guys. Jesus tells a portion of this story, a version of this story in Luke 14. I just want to read it to you. It's powerful. It says, once a man gave a great banquet and invited many. And at the time of the banquet, he sent his servants to say to those who had been invited, come, for everyone is now ready. It's ready again, just like Jesus was speaking here. And then, but, circle it. Okay, well, because we always do that here. But, here's a change. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, hey, I bought a field and I must go out and see it. Please have me excused. I bought a field. In fact, as the Greek construction here suggests, that he really said, I'm thinking about buying a field. I'm thinking about it. And I think I'm in the process of buying a field. I think I need to go check it out. And he was too busy to come. Another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen. That's 10 oxen. They're yoked 2 and 2. So 5 yoke of oxen, and I have to go see them. I have to go examine them. I'm too busy. I got to go check out the livestock. I'm just too busy to come. So please excuse me too. And then the next one says, and this is a great one, okay? And another said, I've married a wife, and therefore I can't come. And there's all sorts of lines I could use there, none of which would be acceptable, okay? I've married a wife, and I can't come anymore. And so the servant came, and he reported these things to the master. And then the master of the house became angry and said to the servant, go quickly to the streets and lanes of the city and bring in the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame. Bring them all. Look at this. It says he goes to the streets and the lanes and invite them all. Look at this next. And the servant said, sir, what you have commanded we have done, and still there is room. There's still room in the banquet hall. And he goes, great. The master says to the servant, well, now go out to the highways and the hedges. Go past the streets and the lanes. Go to the highways. Go to the hedges. People are hiding in bushes. I want you to find them. I want you to go get them, and I want you to invite them to the banquet. Wow. And it says, and compel the people to come in, that my house may be filled. That is the heart of the king, that his house would be filled. That's what he's all about. So let's go back and now see what happens in the story here in Matthew 22 and verse 11. But when the king came in, and so it's filled, right? The place is filled. And here comes the kicker. This is a tough one. But when the king came in to look at the guests, he saw there a man who had no wedding garment. And you go, okay, what's that all about? Doesn't mean that he doesn't have anything on. It means that he has the wrong thing on. And you go, oh. So you go to a wedding, and there's kind of a protocol, right, of what you wear. You don't wear, you know, your sweaty workout clothes. That's probably a little bit low. I mean, it's pretty casual today what we wear, but you don't wear your dirty clothes. But he says here, you didn't have his wedding garment on. You go, well, what's that about? Well, let's kind of keep going, and we'll come back. He says to him, friend, how did you get in here without a wedding garment? And the guy had no explanation. He was speechless. He had no excuse. So you think, okay, what is this thing called a wedding garment? So here's the deal. In those days, especially for a wealthy person, when you were invited to the wedding, the guy throwing the wedding, here in this case the king, he would supply a wedding garment for you to wear. When you got there, they would have this very ornate, beautiful garment for you to put on. And it wasn't so everybody looked cultish and all in the same, you know, clothing, but it was so that you had beautiful, pure linen on that was ornate. And everyone had their own, that had a wedding garment to put on. It was really a beautiful, beautiful thing. And this guy didn't have a wedding garment. It's not that he couldn't afford one, it's the fact that he wouldn't receive it from the king. He refused. He said, I'm going to come here, and I'd like to be a part of the party, but I'm going to do it on my terms, thank you. Not on your terms, king. I'm going to reject what you have for me, and I'm going to create for myself whatever I think I need to do this thing. It's on my terms, not your terms. Right? And so he rejects the kindness and the generosity of the king. He says, I'll wear whatever I want to wear, thank you. And he says, well, that's not going to work. Now, so he was speechless. Now look at this. I think what we need to wear is what's referred to in Romans 13. Look at this. Paul tells us to do this. Let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Because the garment you and I wear in this world by ourselves is referred to as the works of darkness. It's tattered and dirty and inappropriate. And I know that's true in my life. What I produce out of the flesh is broken, crummy, inappropriate, trashy things. In my flesh, I have nothing good to offer. All I have to do is look in the mirror and watch myself. And I know that's to be true. And Paul here tells us to cast those things off and to put on the armor of light. That's what we're supposed to be dressed in. Look at this. Let us walk properly as in the daylight, not in orgies or drunkenness, not in sexual immorality or sensuality, not in quarreling and jealousy. I mean, it takes it from kind of the way out there stuff to the right here stuff, right? Even our quarreling and our jealousies. But he says, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. To put on the Lord Jesus Christ as a garment is what he's talking about. The same garment that they're going to do at this wedding. That this guy decided, I don't need your garment. I'm going to wear my own garment, thank you. And it's going to be a garment of darkness. I want to hang out in this thing called the party, but I'm not on your terms, God. It's going to be on my terms. God says, that doesn't really work. Look at this. In fact, verse 13. And then the king said to the attendants, bind him hand and foot and cast him into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. A very hellish place. Because here's the deal. He says, I'm going to do this on my terms. And then he says, then you have to live according to your terms. And in your brokenness and in your sin, there's no place at the wedding feast for you. But in the garment that I want to give you, it is an incredible place for you. I want you to be the wedding feast and to wear the righteousness of Christ that I want to give to you. And then he wraps it all up by saying this, for many are called, but few are chosen. This mysterious interaction in sequence of the sovereignty and drawing call of God that results in the conviction and surrender of our wills to him. For many are called and few are chosen, but many are called. He says, go into the streets, go into the lanes, go into the highways, go right into all the hedges and bushes and invite people to the wedding feast. And God will supply the garment that you need to wear. Because, you know, sometimes you get invited to a wedding and you go, well, I don't have anything to wear. And it's not just gals who say that. Guys say that, right? And they go, what am I going to wear? And he goes, man, don't worry about it. I've got something for you to wear. I'll take my garment, my son's garment, and I'll put it on you. You get to wear the robe of Christ. And it'll be the most appropriate thing ever that you get to be there. Wow. So, here's the deal. Let's go back to the parable of the wedding banquet. People celebrate. Here's what I think he's saying is that honoring faith realizes that the privilege of being intimate with God is supplied by the righteousness that Christ provides for us. The privilege of being intimate with him isn't by anything that we've done. Because most of us have either said, hey, I'm too busy, or I'm totally hostile, or I'm going to do it on my own terms, thank you. But to be intimate with him, it is supplied by the righteousness that Christ provides for us. The garment he provides for us. That's what makes us intimate with him. So what do we do with this? What do we do with it? Here's what I'd like us to do with it. I just have a few thoughts here that I think summarize this thing. In the face of our poverty, our handicaps, our blindness, and our lameness, the condition of the human soul, in the face of that, secondly, we are divinely called to surrender our ragged and worn-out garments in exchange for putting on the righteousness of Christ at his expense. He bought it for us unconditionally and offers it to us to wear. Wouldn't that be a beautiful thought? He comes and he's got it draped over his arms. And he said, I'd like you to wear this. You go, I don't deserve that. He goes, I know. But I love you and I bought it for you. I want you to wear this. And it makes it, and it cleans your life. That's what we're going to do this morning as we do communion. He's going to offer his body broken for us and his blood shed for us, that through that it makes us clean. It's like coming to the wedding supper. This is just kind of a reenactment. In fact, Jesus, when he did this with his disciples in the upper room, he said, I'll never do this again until the wedding supper of the Lamb, and I do it with you again. He is waiting to do this with us at some point in the future. Is that like wild? But he said, but I want you to do it now in remembrance of me, anticipating that day. That's what we're going to do this morning. And so he wants us to take this, our ragged garment, and exchange it for his, which, now you guys hear, which is the only appropriate and acceptable attire for the most incredible celebration in all of history. The only appropriate attire is the righteousness of Christ, the garment that he gives us. And it'll be an incredible party. It is a wedding banquet where Christ is the bridegroom. And those who have trusted him are not only invited, but we find out that at the end of the day, we are the bride of Christ. That is amazing. That's what we're called to. So let's go back to the party here. I have another picture. I love this picture. And it's this deal. The honoring faith accepts God's invitation to the banquet that he hosts and where he provides the appropriate dress. That's what honoring faith means. We accept the invitation. And we come not only to the party, but the very garment that he provides for us. We say, thank you. Wow, I'm glad to be here. And then here's what he says. Welcome to the party. He says, man, I'm so glad you're here. We've always said here that church is a party. And it is. It's a party for everybody who has a dirty, tattered garment on themselves. It's a party for the people who have never had a party. It's a party for those who are lame and lost and broken. It's a party that God provides at his expense, and he provides the garment. And it's Christ to put him on in our lives. So this morning, as we come to communion, why don't you take a moment just to prepare yourself to come, in a sense, to anticipate this party that's going to happen in Revelation 19 when we are raptured with him and meet him in the sky. He's going to throw an incredible party and let us be a part of it. And he's going to clothe us in the righteousness of Christ. And you're made absolutely new and clean. That all the stuff in your life is forgiven. It is wiped clean. All that list of sins and all that garbage is erased clean because of what he did for us. And he sets us free to live life to its fullest, to the way he really designed it for us. And he gives us the power to do it. So why don't you prepare yourself to come, in a sense, to the party and tell him thank you for him giving his body broken for us and his blood shed for us to make us clean and to make us new. All right? Take a minute to prepare yourself.